There are skeptics out there, though. You know, Amazing Randy doesn't believe in this, claims that he's got $1 million for anybody who can prove him wrong. I've had on this program Michael Shermer, who, of course, heads up the Skeptics magazine. You know him as well?
Well, I've never met him. I've actually written for his magazine, and we've been in email contact. I've never met him personally.
Skeptical Inquirer, I believe, right?
No, his magazine's called The Skeptic.
The Skeptic,
and there's an advocacy group called PSYCOP, the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal. They publish The Skeptical Inquirer. So there's several rival skeptical outfits there. In fact, you know, there's a whole skeptical industry.
Which is healthy.
Oh, yeah. I think it's healthy, but I don't think their skepticism's necessarily healthy. I think healthy skepticism is open-minded, you know. You want to know the facts, you want to see the evidence, fair enough. That's why I spend most of my time doing experiments, you know, trying to provide facts and evidence and find out more. I think that's perfectly healthy. What isn't healthy is dogmatic skepticism, people who've got a belief system, a kind of scientific fundamentalists, who think they know the truth already. They don't need the facts.
And, would they take your data and let's say it proved beyond a question of a doubt?
Well, they don't. What they don't, I mean, take Michael Shermer. Here's an interesting case. When my book, The Sense of Being Stared At, and Other Aspects of the Extended Mind, came out in the U.S., there was a feature about the book in USA Today newspaper. In the journalists writing the thing, they, you know, in journalists, they always have to get a skeptic. That's the reason these skeptic groups flourish, because there's a media convention, you've got to have a skeptic. And they form these organizations, say, okay, we're the skeptics, call us. So they're on every journalist's sort of telephone Rolodex. They ring them up. So Shermer's one of the people they always ring up. They rang up Shermer, said to him, you know, what do you make of Sheldrake's evidence and stuff. So he said, and was quoted in the paper as saying, everything Sheldrake claims can be explained by perfectly normal means. It's all rubbish. So when I saw this, I thought, okay, well, let's hear how he does explain it. So I emailed him and said, I've read your quote. You know, what is the perfectly normal explanation for all these things? And he replied saying, oh, I can't tell you in detail. I haven't read your book. I haven't seen your book.
Uh-huh.
And so then I said, okay, well, why not read it, and we'll have a public debate.
Sure.
I challenged him to a public debate on the Internet.
Bring him on the show.
Well, that would be another possibility.
Yep.
I challenged him to this public debate. He accepted the challenge, but months later, he said, oh, I haven't got around to reading the book. I'm much too busy. So basically his line is, you know, it's all rubbish. I've got another explanation, but when it comes to the evidence, he hasn't got time to read it and can't be bothered. So he's never actually agreed to this challenge. I mean, he agreed to the challenge, but he's avoided it. Doing it on your show might indeed be a perfect way of doing it.
Yeah, we'll see if we can arrange something like that. He's been on the program before. He's debated a little bit before, so he's not opposed to that.
No. And he's an articulate and he's a smart guy. So I think that would be a good idea. I mean, I have had debates with skeptics here in Britain. Two of them, in fact, are available in streaming audio on my website. One's a famous British skeptic called Lewis Wolpert, who's a leading scientific figure. He's always saying the paranormal is bunk and it's all rubbish and so forth. I challenged him to a debate at the Royal Society of Arts in London. We had a judge in the chair. It's a very distinguished audience. This is a, you know, sort of highly respectable establishment organization. We had half an hour each to present our case. He went first, and after 10 minutes he sat down because he said, you know, it's rubbish, it's pathological science. Anyone who believes it is stupid or has got something wrong with them. You know, these people are all frauds and charlatans and so forth. But after he'd said that several times, he couldn't go on saying it. He sat down. Then I stood up and talked about the evidence, went through lots of evidence, my own experiments, Dean Radin's experiments, you know, the reviews of the literature, stuff from journals, tons of evidence. And it turned out he hadn't read any of it. And when I showed the evidence, I had PowerPoint presentation, I showed a video of an experiment and so forth. He sat on the stage in front of the screen. He didn't even turn around to look at it. He stared out looking bored, tapping a pencil on the desk.
Oh, my God.
The entire audience could see he was doing that. And then it turned out he was so convinced it's rubbish, treated all the evidence with such contempt that he didn't think it was even necessary to turn around to look at it. And he lost the entire audience. His performance in that debate was disastrous because he revealed his ignorance and prejudice. And yet, the media treat him as an authority. Now, there are some well-informed skeptics. One of them in Britain here is called Professor Chris French. I had a debate with him at Trinity College, Cambridge, a few months ago. That, again, is on my website in streaming audio. He is informed. He does read the evidence. And he says, yes, there's a lot of interesting evidence. These things do seem to show significant effects. I can't think of other explanations for them right now, except some people might have been cheating, but I agree there's no evidence they were, and so on. He says, I'm a skeptic, I just don't think there's enough evidence, we need more research. Well, that's a much more reasonable position. So there are reasonable skeptics like that, but interestingly, he doesn't get angry and upset and emotional like the dogmatic skeptics.
Sure. Do you think if some of these skeptics had one true experience of things that we've been talking about, something telepathic, something that maybe showed them some proof of the afterlife, they would change their minds, or do you think they would be in denial?
I think it's hard to tell. It would depend on the person. There's examples of both. Most people who believe in these things don't believe in them because they've spent hours studying detailed statistical evidence. They believe in them because they've had the experiences themselves. And that's true of a lot of scientists. It's not true to think that all scientists are skeptics. They're not. When I give talks in scientific institutes, I find most people are actually open-minded, and most of them have had these experiences. I mean, telephone telepathy, thinking of someone who then rings on the phone, about 80% of the population have had that experience. So we're not talking about things that are very, very rare or obscure. Most scientists are normal people, and they've experienced them too, and most of them are interested because of that. But when you have a dogmatic skeptic, someone who's got a worldview that says these things are impossible, if they have these experiences, say with a phone call, they think of someone who then rings, or they have some striking thing, they think about somebody, they later find out that person's had an accident. So there's a striking types of telepathy like that. Yes, they go into denial, some of them. They say, oh, well, it was just a coincidence, you know, and if you think there's anything more, it's just reading something into a coincidence. The human brain has the capacity to attribute purpose to things where none really exists, and so forth. Then they go into a long thing about how our brains can deceive us, and so forth. So, yes, for the true believer in skepticism, you know, that's denial is the course of action they take.